some point, we're going to decide these can't come out of the ground. They have to stay there. And if those companies have not adapted by going to some other form
James
of
Powell,
renewable energy.
I want to thank you for being with us. We have to end it there. Former president of Reed College and Franklin and Marshall and former president of Franklin Institute and former director of the Los Angeles County Museum, Natural History Museum. And thank you so much to Becca Konomopoulos.
And please, folks, go
thank
to thenaturalhistorymuseum.org.
We have to leave it there. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Next up is the evening news.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the film Occupy the Farm, playing at the Clinton Street Theater Thursday, April 2nd at 6:30 p.m.
Our main concern is water right now.
The university actually shut off our water.
What we're going to be doing is handing buckets over the fence.
Occupy the Farm tells the inspiring story of 200 farmers who occupy the last piece of farmland in California's urban East Bay, planting 15,000 seedlings to feed the community and disrupt plans to build a shopping mall. That's Occupy the Farm, Thursday, April 2nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hey, hey.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. House passes a Medicare doc fix bill.
Oregon lawmakers have passed a bill that would require background checks for private gun sales.
And Saudi Arabia has begun strikes on rebels in the capital of Yemen, who deposed the country's president last month.
Good evening. This is the evening news on KBOO Radio for Thursday, March 26th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Jackie Malmstrom. First, a correction. On last night's news, we incorrectly identified the Oregon Congressional Representative Peter DeFazio as a Republican. He is actually a Democrat. An alliance between student groups and farm workers is organizing a nationwide boycott against the Wendy's restaurants. On Saturday in St. Petersburg, Florida, the Student Farm Worker Alliance unveiled plans to boycott Wendy's on several college campuses and in nearby communities across the country. They want Wendy's to join their Fair Food Program, spearheaded by the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group of mostly migrant workers who based in southwest rural Florida. Several fast food and grocery chains have signed on to the Fair Food Agreement, but Wendy's and the other large southern grocery chain Publix remain holdouts. During Saturday's march and concert for Fair Food in St. Petersburg, Free Speech Radio news reporter Sean Kinane interviewed Gerardo Reyes of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers about the alliance's fight for farm worker justice.
Amy Matusko, Chair Prezansky, Senators. I'm here on Benton County District Attorney's behalf today, and I have been working as a district attorney in Oregon for a short time, but I spent a number of years in Washington State as a prosecuting attorney. They're mostly focusing on domestic violence crimes. And I can tell you, coming from a more rural county, firearms are prevalent.
In Michigan, The violent arrest of an African-American motorist by two white police officers in Inkster was caught on video and shows police brutally beating a man who claims he did nothing wrong. Inkster police officers said they pulled over 57-year-old Floyd Dent for violating a traffic violation in January. The dash cam video, which was obtained by local TV station WDIV and released on Tuesday, shows Dent opening the door to his car, only to be met by an officer who draws his gun and aims it directly at him. Officers dragged Dent out of the vehicle, forced him face down to the ground, and put him in a chokehold. According to police reports obtained by the TV station, the primary officer served 16 punches to Dent's head, leaving his face bloody and his body bruised. More officers arrived on the scene and attempted to place Dent in handcuffs. The video shows Dent attempting to cover his face to lessen the impact of the punches, but one officer uses a stun gun on him three times, and a third tries to place him in handcuffs. Police said they pulled Dent over for failing to make a complete halt at a stop sign. Dent, who was unarmed and has no criminal record, said he was not intentionally trying to get away. Dent's account of the altercation differs significantly from that of police, who said that Dent threatened to kill the officers and bit one of them during the incident. However, police have not produced any recording of the threat or photographs of the alleged bite marks. The incident led to a protest of around 50 demonstrators who rallied outside of the Detroit Area Police Department on Wednesday to speak out against this case of police brutality.
A state medical examiner has confirmed that the African-American man who was found hanging from a tree in Claiborne County, Mississippi on Thursday was 54-year-old Otis Byrd. The FBI shared few new details about the case, but said that an autopsy is being conducted. Preliminary results are expected to be revealed sometime next week. Law enforcement officials have yet to say whether Byrd took his own life or was killed, and if he was killed, whether his death was the result of a potential hate crime. Byrd was last seen on March 2nd after a friend dropped him off at a casino in nearby Vicksburg. Family members filed a missing persons report on March 8th. A similar possible lynching took place last August in North Carolina when the body of 17-year-old Lennon Lacey was found hanging from a swing set near his home. Despite the evidence that he was murdered, including the fact that his shoes have been replaced by a pair two sizes too small, detectives ruled in December of 2014 that Lacey's death was a suicide.
Teens here in Portland are being invited to participate in a dialogue with the mayor this weekend to share their experiences and opinions on police profiling. The event is being organized by the Creative Leaders of Portland and will be held at the Center for Intercultural Organizing at 700 North Killingsworth Avenue. The group, which was organized this past February in response to ongoing police violence in communities of color, aims to use their strengths to create the future they wish to see in the communities of Portland. The Creative Leaders of Portland are calling on Portland teenagers to be a part of the conversation with Mayor Charlie Hales about their experiences of being profiled by police in our neighborhoods. Teens are also encouraged to share their ideas on the work that can be done to see better relationships evolve with the Portland police and to tap into our inherent powers as a community to walk in peace on our streets. After the meeting with Mayor Charlie Hales, people then plan to gather outside the Center for Intercultural Organizing on North Killingsworth to celebrate the March 12th innocent verdict for a high school sophomore, Ty Gurule, by Judge Diana Stewart. Gurule was with his older brother and a friend in North Portland last November when he was stopped by Officer Betsy Hornstein in a stop which was previously ruled unlawful by the judge. Two more officers showed up and proceeded to try to handcuff Gurule, at which time he tensed up and the officers began forcing him to the ground. As Gurule struggled against the officers, he was kneed, punched, had his hair pulled, and he was ultimately tasered by one of the officers. The celebration of the innocent verdict will include live music and a Know Your Rights interactive demonstration. The discussion with the mayor begins at 10 a.m. this Saturday, and the rally will be at 1:30 p.m. at 700 North Killingsworth Avenue at the Center for Intercultural Organizing.
Today, Oregon lawmakers introduced a bill that would require background checks on private gun sales into the state Senate. Previously, buyers of guns on the internet or from private individuals were exempt from background checks. Under the bill, sales of guns to law enforcement or back to their own original owners or sales between family members would be exempt. The bill would also ban the sale of guns to individuals under outpatient treatment for mental health if there was a likelihood that they could hurt themselves or others. Individuals that violated the ban would be subject to a year in prison, a $6,000 fine, or both. Repeat offenders could be subject to a 10-year prison sentence and a $250,000 fine, or both. Gun rights advocates in Oregon are protesting the bill, saying that existing legislation is already inefficient.
Another bill that was introduced this week in the Oregon legislature will prohibit possession of firearms or ammunition by a person who is subject to a restraining order issued under the Family Abuse Prevention Act. It also prevents the possession of a firearm by anyone who has been convicted of certain misdemeanor crimes involving domestic violence. Here's a clip of the testimony on this bill at yesterday's committee hearing.
Amy Matusko, Chair Przanski, Senators. I'm here on Benton County District Attorney's behalf today, and I have been working as a district attorney in Oregon for a short time, but I spent a number of years in Washington State as a prosecuting attorney there, mostly focusing on domestic violence crimes. And I can tell you, coming from a more rural county, firearms are prevalent more. You're having individuals who have those firearms in their home, not as a means of protection solely, but as a day-to-day tool, as a hunting resource, as a means of amusement and fun. And then when you combine domestic violence in a rural county where victims don't have access to resources, they don't have a neighbor that they can run to, maybe it's miles to the next person that can help them, when you combine firearms with domestic violence in a rural county, it's an apparent and imminent need to enforce and restrict domestic violence abusers from having those. When we're looking at domestic violence is like a spider web offense. It's got filaments that reach out into the community, and they touch more than just victims of abuse. They touch children, they touch doctors and nurses who deal with these, they touch law enforcement. And when you hold an offender accountable, whether it's under having a conviction for an assault, a conviction for strangulation, or being subject of a protection order, you're sending a good message to all of those individuals who are part of that spider web. You're sending the message that we will protect victims, we will protect communities, we will protect kids. Those threats of firearms in the home are subtle. Often intimidation, as you've already heard, and it's used, say, an individual who's wearing the gun on his hip, and the subject does something they don't like, all they have to do is reach to their hip. That's all that's needed, because they've enforced that message. I've heard from multiple victims over the years about that it takes so many times before they have the strength to come forward, the strength to do anything about it, and that those are issues that are in their home daily, and those threats are to their kids and to their pets and to their families. When you're looking at messages and indirect impacts, think of the kids in that home where that abuser is using that firearm as a tool. What you're teaching children is that firearms are tools to get what they want, to use that. And those kids are taking those messages out even further. Okay? Restraining orders are wonderful, but they're only pieces of paper. And in Washington, I had the particular instance where an 82-year-old woman was subject to violence in her home, where her longtime boyfriend had threatened her and her adult son with a gun. Because of her age, she wasn't comfortable in taking this outside of her home, but she was so concerned that she let her adult son know, and he started a protection order process. And when he went in Washington State and got that protection order, they specifically asked that he not be allowed to possess firearms, which the court was able to do in Washington. And what ended up happening is that restraining order was served on that individual and the gun was found. And in that instance, the offender lied about the gun. He tried to hide that gun from the officers. And that victim afterwards was notified that the officers had that gun, and the relief was apparent on her face. And she felt comfortable enough to tell the officer what had happened. That's a real life story of being able to protect a victim in a way that they weren't comfortable to come out in the beginning.
That was testimony from the Oregon legislature on a bill that will prohibit possession of firearms or ammunition by a person who's subject to a restraining order issued under the Family Abuse Prevention Act. The bill will be going to the full Oregon Senate for approval sometime this session.
And now we go to Free Speech Radio news reporter Sean Kinane interviewing Gerardo Reyes of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers about the Wendy's strike.
What has Wendy's response been so far?
Wendy's response is basically to first say that they are already buying from tomato farms that are participating, that are doing the right thing. And while it is true that they buy, this is not a free ride. They are refusing to pay a penny a pound, and that's one of the important demands of this campaign, because that's going to directly address the super-poverty wages that Wendy's, Publix, and other buyers are creating with the way in which they use the market to dictate the prices. Workers receive stagnant wages because of the way in which the market is used. At the same time, they are not doing anything to guarantee that workers' dignity is being respected. What we're asking them to do is to condition their purchasing to the application of the rights under the Fair Food Program and to pay the penny a pound. Their response is to basically step back from Florida and try to concentrate their buying on Mexico and in other places where there's no program, where there's no regulation, where there's no rights for workers. They are looking for a way out, and basically what they are choosing to do, to don't participate in this, is to go to where places where workers are even more exploited in light of a proven solution for these abuses.
You also have been targeting Publix, as you mentioned. How have they responded to your calls?
Publix continues to say that this is a dispute, a labor dispute between workers and their employers. That is only on their minds, because there are 90% of the tomato industry of the state of Florida that are participating under the program. They are doing the right thing, but they need corporations like Publix to also support them by participating, by committing, by concentrating their buying power and support those businesses that are doing the right thing. What Publix is doing is, instead of participating and paying the penny a pound, they are basically saying that this is a labor dispute, that they will never sign an agreement with the workers, that we're asking them to pay directly to the workers a check, and that is not true. They are saying many things to confuse people, they are lying, and it is time for them to stop doing that, to start being a responsible corporation, especially after being a witness of many abusive conditions, including slavery, and still not being able to touch their hearts and realize that it is because of the way in which they ignore the situations on their own supply chain that all of these abuses have happened. For the first time, we have a solution, and it is time for them to get in line with the Fair Food Program. Many people are here today to join us in making this call to Publix and any corporation that refuses to recognize the humanity of the workers. So it's just a matter of time. But this is a great opportunity for them as a business to do the right thing without crucifying, without destroying the ability of workers to live in to live a dignified life.
And finally, I want to ask you about the turnout. What do you think about the response that you've gotten in St. Petersburg?
We had thousands of people marching with us on the parade, and then we had more people that came to enjoy the music and hear, see some of the theater that we created from Immokalee. And there's a lot of people that have been dancing. There's an atmosphere of celebration, but there's also a atmosphere of struggle. A lot of the people that are here because they want to hear what are the next steps on both campaigns. They are listening carefully to what the coalition and the alliances that are closer to the coalition are organizing in the Southeast, focusing on Publix, but also nationwide, focusing on Wendy's. And it is an ongoing and growing, fast-growing movement. This movement is going to, sooner or later, cut Publix and Wendy's at a point in which it's going to be impossible for them to participate in something like this. Because at the end, the consumers have the last word. And more consumers are demanding the same thing, fair food now. So I would say to Publix, and I would say to Wendy's, for how long you think you can hide from the justice that the workers have been seeking for so long? For how long are you gonna ignore your own consumers? And for how long you think that unjust conditions in the fields are a good business for you? For how long you think that your image is gonna resist being tied to the abusive conditions that you have allowed to be part of it?
That's Gerardo Reyes of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers speaking Saturday at the March and Concert for Fair Food. Sean Canaan, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Florida.
According to a new report, U.S. soldiers in Colombia sexually abused more than 50 children between 2003 and 2007. None of them faced punishment in either the U.S. or Colombia due to diplomatic immunity agreements. More than half of the victims sexually assaulted by American military personnel in Colombia between 2004 and 2007 were children, according to a comprehensive report issued earlier this week. Historian from the University of Bogota, Regan Vega, was commissioned to produce a study about the impacts of long-standing conflict by the Colombian government. Vega cites the diplomatic immunity offered to our armed forces, although bilateral agreements between nations, as the reason no suspects have been prosecuted. One case from 2007 involves a 12-year-old from the southwestern area of Melgar, whose family has since said to have relocated due to death threats. Though prosecutors established the victim had been drugged and subsequently raped inside the military base, law enforcement wasn't allowed to arrest the suspects, who were later flown out of the country. Another incident from the same city in 2004 implies as many as 53 underage girls were sexually abused by soldiers and military contractors from the U.S., who reportedly filmed the abuse and then sold the footage as pornographic material.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. Then at 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly cloudy with a high of about 70 degrees, a low of 49. In other words, another beautiful day. Today in history, back in 1979, while Jimmy Carter was president, the Camp David Peace Treaty was signed between Egypt and Israel, ending 30 years of fighting between the countries. It was the first peace treaty between an Arab nation and a Jewish state. The quote for today is from the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw, who said, "Independence? That's middle-class blasphemy. We all depend on one another, every soul of us on earth."
It's 5:22, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Do the crime, do the time, goes the old saying. Unless, of course, the criminals are corporate executives. In those cases, the culprits are practically always given a get-out-of-jail-free card. Even the corporate crimes that produce horrible injuries, illnesses, death, etc., are routinely settled by fines and payoffs from the corporate treasury, with no punishment of the honchos who oversee what amount to crime-for-profit syndicates. The only bit of justice in these money settlements is that some of them have become quite large, with multi-billion-dollar, quote, punitive damages meant to deter the perpetrators from doing it again. Yet, the same bad corporate actors seem to keep at it. What's going on here is a game of winking and nodding in which corporate criminals know that those headline-grabbing assessments come with a secret escape hatch. Congress has generously written the law so corporations can deduct much of their punitive payments from their income taxes. As Senator Pat Leahy points out, this tax loophole allows corporations to wreak havoc and then write it off as a cost of doing business. For example, oil giant BP certainly wreaked havoc with its careless oil rig explosion in 2010, killing 11 workers, deeply contaminating the Gulf of Mexico, and devastating the livelihoods of millions of people along the Gulf Coast. So, BP was socked with a punishing payout topping $42 billion. But, 80% of that is eligible for a tax deduction, a little fact that was effectively covered up by the bosses and politicians. This is Jim Hightower saying Senator Leahy has introduced legislation to lock down this escape hatch for thieves, killers, and executive suite villains. For more information on the moral outrage of ordinary taxpayers forced to subsidize corporate criminals, contact USPIRG at USPIRG.org. Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
An Oregon Senate investigative committee has concluded that Senator Chip Shields did not violate ethics laws by pushing legislation that may have benefited his family business. The Senate Special Committee stated that Senator Shields did nothing wrong when he asked a representative from Oregon to carry the legislation for him. The bill would have required contractors to use biodegradable lubricants in public construction projects. Shields' family owns Schaefer Specialized Lubricants, which sells biodegradable lubricants. Senator Shields is one of the company's sales associates here in the state of Oregon.
Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio today issued a statement praising the decision of the U.S. House to include an extension of the Secure Rural Schools program in a Medicare reauthorization bill, passed today. The program will provide over $180 million to Oregon counties over 2 years to pay for vital services such as education, law enforcement, and road maintenance. The counties will receive federal funding under this program and have a large portion of county land designated as a federal forest land. The compensation program began 8 years ago when timber yields began to drop considerably in these counties due to large-scale deforestation, along with other forest conservation programs. The Secure Rural Schools Act provides consistent and reliable funding for 775 rural counties and 4,400 schools located near national forests across the United States. The act also helps pay for restoration and stewardship projects on our public lands and forests. Representative DeFazio praised the two-year extension of the Secure Rural Schools program and also voiced his support for the CHIP program, which ensures access to health care for all children. He added that the bill passed today secures critical funding for community health centers and expands vital services in underserved areas, as well as guaranteeing continued access to Medicare for millions of America's senior citizens by ending a decade-long cycle of an annual so-called doc fix patches.
The USA Patriot Act expires in June, and Congress will once again face a debate on privacy and bulk surveillance. Two members of Congress have reintroduced a bill to rein in the surveillance programs, but the political environment for reform has a poor record thus far. Still, privacy advocates hope a lawsuit from one of the world's most popular websites will mark a new chapter in the fight for what is supposed to be a constitutionally protected right. Anthony J. Rivera has the story from the United States Capitol.
This week, Wisconsin Democrat Mark Pocan and Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey reintroduced legislation in the U.S. House to curb the federal government's dragnet surveillance programs. The Surveillance State Repeal Act seeks to repeal both the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment Act. Sections of these laws built the legal framework for programs that collect data from the telephone and digital communications of people around the world without probable cause of wrongdoing. Congressman Pocan thinks it's time to dial things back.
What we're trying to do is not just tinker around the edges like some of the past provisions have been, but this is a complete overhaul of our surveillance system, our state surveillance system, getting rid of the Patriot Act, getting rid of past executive orders, trying to make sure the NSA can't try to coerce software and hardware companies from making things easier to hack. We think you can find a balance between security and privacy, and that both are important, and that we've gone too far with the the current law. So that's why we're trying to put this major overhaul of the system in. And Thomas Massey and I are hopefully can show you can do it in a bipartisan way.
Earlier in the month, Wikipedia, along with the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, filed a lawsuit against the National Security Agency. The plaintiffs say the NSA has violated the First and Fourth Amendments of the Constitution by tapping upstream traffic, the data from the foundational network of the Internet known as the backbone. What makes this lawsuit different from past challenges to warrantless surveillance is that Wikipedia can point to disclosures by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden to support its argument that it has standing upon which to proceed. Ashley Gorski is an attorney with the ACLU's National Security Project.
What's especially important here is that the government has acknowledged that the NSA engages in upstream surveillance and that the NSA is intercepting traffic by tapping directly into the Internet backbone. And that changes the dynamic because we can say with certainty that the government has intercepted plaintiff's communications. Plaintiffs have suffered constitutional harm as a result.
Gorski says the amount of information now in the public domain about ongoing surveillance programs helps neutralize the government's claim of state secrets privilege. California Democrat Zoe Lofgren introduced legislation in 2013 with Congressman Massey, similar to the Surveillance State Act. She agrees that standing has always been an issue for plaintiffs in privacy cases against the government. And while she wouldn't comment on the Wikipedia ACLU lawsuit, she expressed concerns with the effects this surveillance has had on the First Amendment so far.
I do think in a general sense that because of the NSA's activities, Americans feel that their privacy is being intruded upon, and I think free speech has been chilled, and I think that's a very serious problem.
Privacy champions in the Senate like Ron Wyden of Oregon and presidential hopeful Rand Paul of Kentucky wouldn't comment for the story. But Congressman Pocan points to a recent Pew Research study that says Americans have changed their habits on the web as a result of their awareness of mass surveillance. But intelligence officials maintain the programs are legal. North Carolina Republican Richard Burr, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, wouldn't touch any of the constitutional details of the case, but says his committee has kept a close eye on the activities of America's clandestine services.
I'm not a lawyer, and our committee's not structured for the purposes of trying to determine whether anybody has a legitimate court case. I can only say this, that the committee constantly does our oversight function on our entire intelligence community, and I can with confidence say that from everything we know today, the intelligence community lives within the letter of the law and the letter of presidential executives, executive orders.
The government argues the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendment Act offer valuable tools to protect the public from harm. But because the surveillance programs often fall under the jurisdiction of special FISA courts, the interpretations of those laws used to justify the programs are not public information. FISA courts also approve government surveillance requests at such a high rate that critics call the secretive court a rubber stamp rather than a check on executive power. Wikipedia's co-founder Jimmy Wales says he hopes the federal court hearing his case will rule that the NSA's actions violate the Constitution. But a court order can only go so far without a legislative solution. Meanwhile, the federal government seems poised to expand its digital surveillance programs. The CIA announced a unilateral restructuring push earlier this month. The Justice Department also quietly moved to expand the FBI's authority to remotely search computers via a proposed rule change. And funding for the military's so-called Cyber Command is set to get a big boost in the budget proposal for next fiscal year. Anthony J. Rivera, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Aircraft from a coalition of Arab nations attacked rebel-controlled Yemeni military bases today as part of an ongoing attack on Houthi rebel forces. Houthi, who U.S. officials claim have an affiliation with al-Qaeda, drove Yemen's president out of the capital city, Sana'a, by boat on Wednesday. The coalition of Arab nations loyal to Yemen is led by Saudi Arabia and includes Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, and the United Arab Emirates. The attacks today killed 28 people, including children, and injured another 55, some of them critically. While U.S. forces are not taking part in the actions, they are providing logistical and intelligence support. The president of Yemen has fled to neighboring Saudi Arabia. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia began bombing Houthi rebels in the Yemen capital of Sana'a. Medical officials in the capital say that at least 45 people have been killed in the strikes. The Shiite rebels deposed the Yemeni president last month. Strikes on Yemen's capital by Saudi Arabia, the region's Sunni Muslim power, has sparked fears that this might be the beginning of a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and the Shiite-majority Iran. The U.S. has offered, quote, logistical and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia in the conflict, although officials have said they will not be taking direct military action.
As many as 17,000 textile workers in Swaziland face losing their jobs following the country's removal from a United States free trade agreement at the start of this year, 2015. Factories that produce clothing for the United States market are closing because they now have to pay costly trade tariffs. Swaziland was removed from the African Growth Opportunities Act, the AGOA, for consistently failing to meet criteria on human rights and freedom of expression. From the town of Manzini, FSRN's Sam Kawe reports.
Since losing her textile factory job in November, Rosemary Hadib has struggled to support her four young sons. Her family has survived on her $860 severance pay, and Rosemary has tried to eke out a living by hawking clothes.
I'm worried about the life, my children, because my children are my priority. Since I'm a single parent, the life they're going to have whilst I'm not employed.
Rosemary and around 1,500 others lost their jobs in November when one of Swaziland's largest textile factories closed. Now, other textile factories have followed suit. The closures come after the United States removed Swaziland from a US free trade bloc, the Africa Growth Opportunity Act, or AGOA, for consistently failing to meet the bloc's criteria on human rights and freedom of expression. Analysts say that Swaziland's exit from AGOA could cost up to 17,000 jobs, a huge number for a country of just 1.25 million. According to Human Rights Watch, unemployment in Swaziland is already at 40%, while the World Bank says that more than 60% of the population lives below the poverty line. The majority of the factories are based here in Manzini, Swaziland's second largest city and industrial hub. Each day, thousands of workers from rural villages come through the city's hectic bus station. Removal from AGOA means textile factories that make clothing for the US market must now pay costly trade tariffs, increasing the cost of production to the point that owners are opting to shut down instead of risk running at a loss. US President Barack Obama first suspended Swaziland from AGOA in May 2014 after years of insufficient progress on meeting AGOA criteria on workers' rights. The government was issued a deadline to amend laws that were considered repressive. One of these laws was Swaziland's Suppression of Terrorism Act, which allows police to break up demonstrations under the pretext of national security and is blasted by critics as a tool to harass and detain activists.
I've been threatened with arrest and actually arrested.
Vanda Mons is Secretary General of ATUSWA, one of Swaziland's largest trade unions. In October, with the AGOA deadline already passed, Vanda and other members of ATUSWA tried to organise a march in an attempt to pressure the government to act before losing AGOA. The day before the march was due to take place, authorities warned Vanda it posed a risk to security. The day after, police arrested Vanda in his home and questioned him for 4 hours. Vanda says that the Swazi authorities are reluctant to address AGOA eligibility requirements that provide protections for workers' rights.
Government do not want people to assemble, because if people assemble, they discuss issues. And if people discuss issues, they also chart a way forward on how to address the issues they are raising. But government frowns on that. Then that is why government is reluctant to adhere to the AGOA benchmarks.
Since an economic crisis in 2011, civil unrest in Swaziland has been on the rise. The country is Africa's last absolute monarchy, ruled since 1986 by King Swati III, a flamboyant autocrat, fond of luxury cars and shopping trips to Europe, who exerts tight control over the population. Human rights groups have long criticised Swaziland for arbitrary arrests and imprisonments, as well as for limiting freedom of expression. Political parties are banned. Petrus Kambakuska Magagula is a professor of political science at the University of Swaziland. He says that the loss of AGOA will cause further, more serious unrest as citizens observe the rise of democracy in neighboring South Africa and Mozambique.
As long as the government is behaving in this way, there is no way you can make people change and be submissive the way they were 5 years, 10 years back. No, they won't. And they are not the same people that you were controlling something like 10 years, 20 years ago anyway. These are the new people, the youth.
The AGOA loss is expected to continue to severely damage Swaziland's economy, as workers who lost their jobs will no longer have money to pay for goods and services. Analysts predict the economic effects of Swaziland's removal from AGOA will go beyond the thousands who lose their factory jobs. Each textile worker supports 5 dependents on average. There are also concerns that part of the female majority workforce will turn to prostitution to support their families, exacerbating Swaziland's HIV rate, which is already the highest in the world, affecting about 26% of the population. Swaziland was officially removed from the AGOA trade pact at the beginning of 2015 and now has to reapply, which is a long process. Madagascar, removed in 2009 after a military coup, was just reinstated at the beginning of this year. Sam Cowie for SFRN, Manzini, Swaziland.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, March 26, 2015. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities, kidnap civilians and order families to halt construction of their homes. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday morning the southern West Bank district of Hebron, searched and ransacked homes and kidnapped 5 Palestinians, including 2 children. In addition, several military jeeps invaded Sorif town west of Hebron and handed notices to 6 families, ordering them to halt construction of their homes in Deir Moussa area northwest of the town. Moreover, Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday at dawn a number of Palestinian towns in the occupied West Bank, violently searched homes and handed 6 Palestinians military orders for interrogation. In other news, a Palestinian driver crashed his own car Thursday after an Israeli soldier stopped him, searched his car and forced him to drive to Yitzhar illegal colony near the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The Palestinian contacted the army and told them of what happened. Local media sources announced that Israeli soldier from the Golani Brigade waved the Palestinian driver, 19 years of age, ordering him to stop and search his car before ordering him to drive to Yitzhar illegal colony built on Palestinian lands near Nablus. At the political level, as tension mounts with Washington, Israel's outgoing government has suspended a controversial plan to build hundreds of new settlers' homes in occupied East Jerusalem. According to AFP, the plan involves the construction of 1,500 homes in the settlement neighborhood of Har Homa, where Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gave a controversial speech on the eve of March 17th elections, pledging to build thousands of new homes if returned to office. Today, there are around 550,000 Jewish Israelis living in settlements across the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan, James Helmsworth, and Eric Takeoff. Special thanks to reporters from Free Speech Radio News. Our lovely engineer is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news, or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncorn.
And I'm Jackie Malmstrom. Here's what's coming up tomorrow on KBOO. From 7 to 8, it's Democracy Now!, a news magazine hosted by award-winning journalists Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Positively Revolting Talk Radio, hosted by Ani and Lynn. A variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, it's One Land, Many Voices. Zaha Hassan and Ned Rorsch are the hosts. They explore political, social, and cultural issues affecting Palestine and Israel. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, news, and interviews and commentary hosted by Chris Andre. Stay tuned for Flashpoints at 10:15, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Jacob Rubin joins KBOO's Francis Fagan to discuss his debut novel, The Poser. The Poser is a strange and delightful comic novel that at its heart speaks to the power of performance, impersonation, acting, and what it means to find the essence of someone and of yourself. At 11:30, it's a special report for Making Contact on the politics of coffee. That's all right here on KBOO, your community radio station. If you're not yet a member of KBOO, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Good night, Jackie.
Good night, Robert.
And stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Another chapter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement has been leaked by WikiLeaks. These newly leaked classified documents show that the secretive deal, if it goes through as written, will dramatically expand